this is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
What the hell's going on? You are listening to RTRFM 92.1. This is the Indie Media Show, your grassroots activist media program, and we are broadcasting from the unceded lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. I'd like to offer my respects to them and their elders past and present. You are with myself, Joni Boyd, and Zoe. How's it going, Zoe?
Hey, I'm going great. Joni, how are you this morning?
Yeah, no, I'm good. I was very much admiring the clouds today. Very happy to be in the studio together. We haven't actually like been in the studio at the same time, the two newbies.
Yeah, it's so also nice to have some like female and female energy in indie media. It has felt a little bit like a boys' club for a while.
It gets a little bit dour on the show.
Yeah.
It's just the boys. But speaking of boys, thanks to Jeff for another fantastic on the record. Hope you're doing well. How are you doing, Jeff? He's wearing a Spice Girls shirt. So he must be doing all right.
The connoisseur of amazing shirts.
So our usual main host, Ray, is over in Italy. He's got a report for us a little later on the Insurgiamo movement in Italy. He went to a protest that was 15,000 strong that emerged out of GKN and Fridays for Future, the student climate justice movement. And Insurgiamo means we rise up, and it's a coalition of ecological, economic and social justice movements confronting capitalism. We've got a big story on that on the ground, classic indie media gonzo kind of stuff. What have you got for us, Zoe?
I'm going to start off after our first track chatting about how serious the homelessness is going on in not only Perth but Western Australia more broadly, and the key fact that we do not have enough housing within the state as well as around Australia. So Justin Owen had a chat to me about the planning and architectural aspects, and we'll be hitting that
very
later.
Very important side of the conversation that we don't always delve into. That you know the architecture and the planning itself is you know very much a contributing factor to the issues that homeless people face.
Yeah, it's really complex.
So very much looking forward to that chat, and we'll have some headlines a little later on for you.
As of the 1st of October, 34 people had died on the streets of Perth alone. This is an average of one per week, most under the age of 50. And that only highlights the concern within the state's metropolitan. Many of the peak bodies, such as WACOS, have called for more state housing as a fundamental need, as well as the increase to New Start to assist getting tenants into the private rental market. Right now, the vision of a more state housing exists only in abstract, but it is possible to materialise these ideals. Justin Owen, architect and senior lecturer at Curtin University, spoke with me about the ways in which we could implement changes while also reflecting upon the current funding provisions. As it has been 2 years since the McGowan government released the Social Housing and Economic Recovery Package, Justin explains if a mere 250 new builds plus a stimulus package were a step in the right direction, or if there could have been a more prudent and sustainable initiative which would aptly tackle the issue of housing availability within the state.
I think, as you suggest, the 250 new builds and the increased stimulus for maintenance was a good start, but it's a very minimal start given the scale of the current problem in Western Australia and across Australia, actually. I think the current administration are committed to approaching and dealing with this problem as best they can, but I think there are many structural problems and hurdles to the efficient delivery of housing that can't be met by market-led solutions, and I think that's why the introduction, as the Grattan Institute proposed in 2021, of a social housing future fund at a federal level that would then also enable support at the state level would be so important to allow a proper level of investment over 20 billion across Australia to be put into housing, and also to treat housing as infrastructure, as something that's vital to our society. In the same way that we treat roads as vital infrastructure, we should treat housing as vital infrastructure even more so, because it deals with the fabric of society. I think that the real issue is that good quality social housing can't be delivered within a market situation. It has to be subsidized in one way or another through federal and state government methods.
Given a large number of those still seeking or currently in inadequate social housing are our First Nations people requiring larger homes, as well as disabled and elderly people unable to function without accessible housing, where is the government failing to fulfil these fundamental needs?
I think the government's trying very hard. I think in terms of First Nations communities, we need to move beyond what often is called consultation to partnership with those communities, and let those communities be a part of leading the answer to the housing problem in those communities. I come from a background of working in co-design practices in Britain on what some people might have described as failed housing estates, and my experience as an architect and design architect in those situations of working closely with people who are going to be living in the houses shows that that engagement is critical. You can't do it as if you're airdropping housing from orbit. You have to engage with the First Nations peoples and allow them to lead the process or co-lead the process. And I think one of the great problems that there has been in much housing aimed at Indigenous communities, First Nations communities, is the exclusion of the users in the design process and the consideration process. I also would say that we do have in Western Australia people and institutions with experience in this area, many of them. Shelter WA is one, for example, and also a number of architectural practices that have worked closely with First Nations peoples. In terms of your question around disabled and elderly people and the need for accessible housing, I think universal design, as we call it, should actually be just that. It should be universal. We should be able to treat all homes as places where one can age in place or be fully accessible to all people. I think that the need for flexibility in housing is not helped by the market-led market at the moment in terms of flexibility is not built into housing nearly as much as it can be. And I think that only supplying small numbers of homes with full levels of accessibility, and that's very rare actually, is short-sighted and doesn't capitalize on the investment we're making anyway in building those homes now.
Speaking about high-density housing as a possible solution and the concerns around the risk that these may result in slum-like dwellings, is there a tipping point when it comes to the size of a complex, or is there a way to make it more desirable to private buyers in order to create a combination of both private and public tenants, or are these best kept exclusively as social housing?
Theoretically, there's no limit to the size of a complex, but the really critical issue is having a social mix. It's how our society has operated best in the past. We shouldn't be looking at large-scale complexes, as you put it, for social housing, because it's very easy for those developments to be stigmatized by the actions of very few people in them. And this can lead to a kind of fire-and-forget approach to housing, where we build social housing complexes and then forget about them and then blame people for them not working. One of the major problems about investment in social housing is not just the initial build, but it's the maintenance over time. And I think that's what's critical here. Institutions such as Foundation Housing in WA and Shelter WA will emphasize the need for continued support, maintenance, and social care where it's necessary that wraps around that housing, because this is not just about housing, it's about health and welfare and about society in general.
Given the vast numbers of vacant properties, be that the formal industrial buildings now sit empty in Fremantle, some in a state of disrepair, Could a state-funded redevelopment of these properties be a solution? Is there any viability in the government purchasing and activating these spaces for social housing?
I think that's a really interesting point, and it's probably worthy of a more nuanced debate. But there are really often issues around the reuse of existing buildings, especially those large industrial buildings such as the ones in Frio, that can mitigate against using them in social housing. The cost of redevelopment tends to require a profit level that's well beyond the budget we're currently used to expending on social housing, although I believe that budget has to increase. But the second that budget needs to increase, because in these cases, because the complexity of those buildings, not even the heritage complexity, but the complexity in terms of existing structures, reinforcing them and altering them, makes the use of industrial buildings, existing ones, very difficult. However, I mean, I think what it would be fantastic to see is some of the larger real estate interests championing the integration of social and, as it's also called, key worker housing, including housing for those at risk of homelessness, into those sort of developments. I think we need to be able to look across this spectrum as a spectrum. It's about whole of society issues, not just simply about solving a discrete problem. But the government, again, whether at federal or state or hopefully both levels, needs to be there to reduce the private investor risk and ensure, more importantly, the longer term wraparound support and maintenance. We can't have that fire and forget approach to social housing. And that requires a much wider commitment to support the government, actually, in providing what is a basic social and human right. The point about social housing and homelessness is it's not just a problem for other people. And this is something that we're pushing very strongly at Curtin, both in the School of Design and Built Environment, and also at Uhuru, which is the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute here, where my colleagues Stephen Rowley and Amity James work. In architecture, we've been very much trying to investigate how certain models of housing are designed and used. The best model we've looked at so far in terms of homelessness is the foyer model in Oxford Street in Leaderville by Foundation Housing and Anglicare. And that is a hugely promising prototype, if you wish, but we need far more of them. And I think ultimately we need to consider housing as a societal kindness that is vital to us all, not just those who will find housing. And at DBE here, we're welcoming the engagements of some of our industry partners in looking at these issues, whether it's around the design of foyers for people, young people at risk of homelessness, or in terms of housing in a wider sense through methods such as modularization of housing, which one of my colleagues is looking at, and which, in fact, three groups of our students have just won first, second and third prizes in a national competition, the Fleetwood competition. So I think I'd like to emphasize how much this is on the agenda, both of Curtin and of the School of Design and Built Environment. So thank you very much for having me.
That was Justin Owen, architect and senior lecturer at Curtin University. Since I spoke to Justin, a spokesperson from the WA government said that there are strong considerations for further funding of $2.4 billion over 4 years to improve homelessness services, as well as the construction of 3,300 new social housing properties. But like with everything, we'll wait and see.
Yeah, fingers crossed for that. Don't have a lot of faith in the McGowan government, especially when it comes to housing the homeless. You know, there's always more work we can do, I suppose.
Definitely.
So you are listening to RTRFM 92.1. This is the Indie Media Show. Coming up, we have Ray Grenfell on the ground in Bologna, focusing on the Insurgiamo movement over there.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Many people in Perth would remember the Row 8 and 9 development proposal, which then attracted large protests, and that resulted in the permanent protection of the Belia wetlands and a discontinuation of the government's plans to build the highway. However, now the residents and community that love and make use of the Green Corridor, originally zoned for that highway, yet again having to fight to keep it free of that development.
Hmm.
The Department of Planning, Lands, Heritage are investigating whether the corridor has the suitability of being rezoned for other purposes, and therefore will be holding drop-in sessions at the Hamilton Hill Memorial Hall on Wednesday the 26th from 2 to 5 p.m., Saturday the 29th from 9 till 12, and on Wednesday, the 2nd of November from 4 to 7. It is imperative that these green spaces, such as Randwick Stables and Clontarf Hill, remain undisturbed because we need these spaces.
Absolutely.
To connect with nature rather than just have housing and development impede everything. So next week, we're going to be chatting to Christine Duckham more about the topic. But if you can, I strongly encourage you get down to the Hamilton Hill Memorial Hall and participate in these drop-in sessions. I'll post a bit on the Indie Media Facebook page with the details. So if you missed what I just said, head to our Facebook page.
Please do. Thanks, Zoe. Really important fight, that one. And, we all thought it might have been done back in 2017 with the election of the state Labor government, but looks like the fight continues.
No, there are areas that have been heritage listed and protected, but let's just build around them.
Yeah, like you know, that'll keep them just fine. All right, before we get too riled up about that, onto our next story. While news of Giorgia Meloni's neo-fascist party, Brothers of Italy, rising to power in Italy, has caused much concern for people of conscience everywhere, there are also signs of hope from the Mediterranean basin. The GKN Factory Collective, an organisation born from a workers' struggle and general strike in Florence and occupation of the Campi Bisogno GKN plant, have joined forces with the Fridays for Future Student Climate Justice movement. This movement in Sorgiamo, translated as We Rise Up, has brought together a coalition of ecological, economic and social justice movements to confront the crisis of Italian capitalism. On Saturday, an estimated 15,000 people gathered in Bologna in the latest manifestation of this movement, marching and dancing through the streets and occupying a highway. Indie Media's Raymond Grenfeld was there to speak to some of the participants of this new movement.
We can hear because we need to connect all the struggle, and today is a very good day for try to construction this kind of connection with communists and anarchists and all the movement for ecology, for workers, and maybe for me it's a very simple question is this is the way.
And this movement started with GKN in Florence. Can you explain to people that are not familiar what the history is?
GKN is a collective inside the factory. The name is GKN. And after a lot of fired, they try to construction a huge connection with the other outside the movement, with the movement, with the ecology movement, with the workers' movement in all of the city. And this is very important because the factory goes outside and try to connect it with the entire world outside, entire struggle world outside. And I think maybe 3 years ago, the GKN started to this journey, and now I think it's the good time with the new government, your far-right government, to try to take another step in that direction. This is the short story about the GKN.
That initially in GKN, was there an industrial action or strike action, or was it more just, what was the initial situation in GKN? Was there Like, what was the struggle to begin with?
But in the beginning?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the beginning, because a lot of people inside the GKN factory, they are fired, no? Yeah. And the other people try to stop this. This pirate, these...
They're going to be sacked.
Exactly. And after that, they discussion about, okay, this is good, but just for the factory. We need to have good practice for for outside. And start this journey in this way.
Yeah. I think a lot of my friends in Australia, a lot of comrades, they often talk about the old anti-globalization movement, and when, you know, like the global anti-capitalist movement, when it was a lot stronger and there was this kind of network and we had the social forum movement and stuff. But lately it's been maybe like very quiet and dead, like in terms of international solidarity and this kind of global movement. Do you think that this movement here in Italy has the potential to grow into something similar, or...?
Maybe yes, because now it's the time to connect all the forces against the enemy, and of course the capitalism is one of the biggest enemy. And all the in Italy, for example, now it changed the government for the far right way, and I think that now it's a good time for try to connect the country Italy, but all of the world. And I think maybe it's the new beginning about the early, the end of the 90s and stuff like that. Maybe it's a good time, and maybe I think it's a start a new era.
And just finally, because you know you're involved with ZAM, what do you think that even today the social centers are still very connected to this movement, and are here sort of representing and are still a necessary part of this movement?
Of course, I think now the social center is very important about the welfare in the community, yeah, in the place, in Milan, in the big city or stuff like that. But it's necessary to open the door and go outside and construction a movement outside with a community, construction a good community, connecting the community, and go outside in the new struggle against capitalism.
Sorry. One last final question. I guess, you know, one sort of important question for, like, I guess someone like myself and maybe you is, like, the involvement of, like, trade unions or workers' organizations. I mean, obviously, GKN started from a workers' struggle, but, I mean, now I'm not sure whether the trade union movement in Italy is represented here today or is very active. Is there any opportunity, do you think, to try and... work with the institutional trade unions and workers' movement to bring them into this kind of movement?
Yeah, I think that the GKN organized with the base union.
Yeah.
Is our self-organized union, and maybe this is the way, because the the federal union, it's very contaminate about the Democratic Party capitalist shit and stuff that. Maybe it's good to start with a basic union and the movement, and maybe this is the new power, because the basic union stay inside the factory and work with the workers inside the worker life, not just in the table, in the government, stuff like that.
So in a way, it's like a new kind of form of workers' organization is needed.
Maybe yes, not just for the workers, but maybe just for everybody. Yeah. Because now the worker world is not like in the 90s with the factories or stuff like that. Now it's all, a lot of people goes in autonomous worker and stuff like that. I think maybe it's the way is the construction, a struggle inside the precarious class.
It's like the gig workers and stuff like this.
The gig workers, exactly.
You will, there's a casualized industry, there's no real, like...
Exactly.
What representation do you have?
And this is now the good way, because the class, it's come back because now the rich part and the poor part, you know. And this is a new form. Maybe we need to organize with a syndicate, with base union and movement and workers, gig workers and stuff like that, organize a a big group about this, about the precarious class, because I think this is the new classes.
A new reality that we and live in as well. Yeah. Okay, yeah. And I mean, do you think that here, like, there are a lot of people share this class consciousness, maybe?
Maybe, yes, but it's very hard to have a good answer for this question, because maybe a lot of young, for example, Fridays for Futures, or this is a huge movement, a lot of people have a privilege for have a struggle, no? Because they don't need to go to work or go to school. But I think now they start a quiet conscience, class conscience, okay? Because now with the high cost for the electricity, about the war,
austerity
and a lot of things. Now I think it's the poor people. Maybe it's a good day, a good time for have a new class theory and class. They recognize in a poor class, and they try to struggle together. Maybe start now. I think it's a long process, and we need to have attention, because a lot of time, for example, in the COVID time, the far right try to catch all the words about the poor classes and against the capitalism.
And to capitalize on this.
Exactly. And like very populist for connecting the poor classes, and this is important with for the left movement to try to organize before that.
World, the time has come to.
You are listening to RTR FM 92.1. This is the Indie Media Show, and you're currently listening to a report by Raymond Grenfeld on the ground in Bologna on the Insurgiamo movement, an anti-capitalist and pro-environment movement over there.
You think it's important that we come here today to Bologna and to express solidarity and to be a part of this demonstration?
I think it's so important because in the phase we are right now, we should totally change our paradigm towards like way we live, way we organize society, also the way we move around. And I think it's a great signal against greenwashing. Greenwashing this stupid expansion of the highway, but like they're picking it as sustainable and green and like a completely technocratic move. That they do it without really consulting the populations, and I think it's important like to stand against this, to ask for a real change, to face the climate crisis, social crisis that we're like facing and will face even more in the future, rather than the greenwashing and the fake like social policies that they're trying to like promote.
And today there's like the also like the representatives of like the GKN and this movement, and there's a lot of different organizations and groups and so forth here. I mean, what do you think in terms about this movement that maybe is connected to GKN in terms of building like a kind of multitude or like a group of different organizations? Do you think you can see this manifesting now and In this kind of demonstration? Do you think it's important? Do you see the networks building a bit?
To be honest, it's a struggle. It's like some sort of like struggle that I joined just recently. So like not here since the start. But what to me what is very important, what is very representative right now, is that like this struggle combines the social struggle, the workers that are being more and more smashed by the capitalist system, the neoliberal system, and the environmental struggles. Two struggles that sometimes were like depicted as opposed, or like they're pretty much disjointed. Well, I think today, I mean, I don't know if we can say it's already like combined, but it's a step towards the combination of these two struggles and towards building maybe a future movement that constantly focuses on both environmental struggle and the social struggle. So yeah, and the fact that we came here to Bologna, I think one of the most alternative and symbolic cities in Italy, where it's a symbol of the resistance, firstly against fascism during after the World War, and but also like it has been the theater of so many struggles, workers' struggles, and so today being here from all over Italy to like reclaim again the new struggle for workers, for environment, I think is super representative, and
I guess, you know, we've just experienced this sort of years of the pandemic as well, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of people, even kind of mainstream commentators at the time, said that, look, we cannot return to normal, you know, like, mm-hmm. But it seems that for, you know, all the governments in the world, no matter mm-hmm. whether they're mm-hmm. right or left-wing neoliberal governments, it's very much now like business as usual, crisis as usual, austerity, and people are being made to pay for the pandemic, made to pay for the crisis. Do you think, and this is, you know, one of the first big demonstrations I've been to since the pandemic, do you think people are conscious of this and aware of this, and for them, like, the experience perhaps of the pandemic made the contradictions become more aware for them?
Yeah, totally, I think so, because what it feels like after the pandemic, there has been like much of an evocation by the system, by the government, by the politicians to return to the normal. To me, it's not even like the normal, it's a normal that is depicted as like in the right direction, like saying, okay, there's been the pandemic, all the issues that we face, but now we're like going towards a better future. But, I mean, I think that's what also they're trying to tell us in the politics. There is like this sort of fake optimism combined with the business as usual, and this makes it even more fucked up, in my opinion. But I think that people are more and more like realizing this, that is that you cannot go back to the normal. The normal was the problem even before the pandemic, and the normal is what caused the pandemic. Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it's I think it's more important to it's always important like to state it every day, like, and with every day louder. Yeah.
And also, I guess, just talking politically, we have a situation now, you know, neoliberalism, where even now in Italy, you know, you had members of the so-called center-left voting for this head of the Senate, the fascist, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah.
And for, like, so we have this complicity within the institutional so-called left. And do you think that there's a growing awareness of people politics outside of the parliamentary system, a politics of like more autonomous movements, or more like extra, you know, like people trying to organize outside of the established institutions and political parties?
I think if it will be like a trend that we'll see more and more in the future, because the neoliberal left and like the center left, or whatever they call them, it's not left at all. It's just like a right wing, a little bit more moderate, on that also like try to open to some sort of like rights, but it's economically and deep down also like it's still right wing somehow, like, because also like if I think back when this kind of like center left was still in power, still they did like awful things against migrants, and they didn't
change much, even in terms of like Berlusconi's media laws, they didn't even change them.
that 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. And it's it's already stealing the government, Berlusconi. This is fucking crazy. I mean, it's nothing is changing at all. It's going even worse. And the left, the center left, they say like, yeah, you should vote for us because we're going to change things. Fuck no, you actually, you're part of it. I mean, there's not so much difference between like the center left and the actual government. So I think that this will lead to a lot of self-organization besides the state. And also like this happened also with the case of Brigate per l'Emergenza, like networks of people that organize to like bring food to and help to like people that couldn't afford it during pandemic, and this was like it was like sort of mutual aid, but I don't know. But at the same time, a little bit skeptical whether this will be like something that will take will spread like nationwide, because I think it might be more of a urban phenomenon, because I think in cities, like in big cities where there are networks of people that are already like already working on that since years, this has more space to flourish, while in other cases in more like a suburban context, I think it's it must be tougher. And there I fear populist and neo-fascist sentiments might grow even stronger.
I was going to ask if you worry that having someone like Meloni in power, I mean, in some ways it's an opportunity for anti-capitalist radical left, because having someone like that in power exposes the contradictions of the system clearly in a way, and maybe it motivates the anti-capitalist radical left to, you know, to demonstrate. But also there is the fear and possibility of like neo-fascist movements in the far right. Is that something that you're concerned about? Or?
Indeed, both like in the what you said, like what could be like a magical outcome, that this like shitty situation, this like very strong situation would like lead to a like shift left, more to the left, and make grow more like a real like radical leftist movement, bring to the left some people that before weren't aware of how fucked up we were and we are now. But at the same time, I think it's gonna be bad for like LGBTQ people and all the oppressed minorities that I wouldn't say that were like being granted many rights with the previous government, but for sure the previous government was less harsh than this one on those civil rights, because of this like on women's rights and regarding abortion and other and patriarchy. I think with this new government, this kind of these people will suffer even more, and everyone will like regarding this.
There will be a crisis and struggle, but maybe that crisis and struggle breeds opportunity in a way that might not have happened if it was just like this same neoliberal center-left government. And
so, yeah, I would say so. But to me, I mean, like a good to conclude in. In a positive way, this question, I would say that maybe what could we hope to see flourish, some sort like another way of organizing, another way of like building networks, under the idea of commons, like Michael Hard, Antonio Negri said in Commonwealth. So like this kind of network of anti-capitalist movement that hopefully should grow even stronger. But this, of course, would exist outside the state, because the state now is it's even more fascist. And so, or like a right wing and neoliberal. So, and after that, I don't know like how this can end. Like this, this right-wing government, but one thing for sure, we should start building the condition for it to end now.
Oh, scioperà. E avanti insieme, uniti nel lottare, tutta la settimana la passo qui con te. E non c'è resa, non c'è rassegnazione, ma solo tanta rabbia che cresce dentro me. Più forte!
So me, I decided to go down. Because I think that this what they are doing, GKN and Fridays for Future Italy, is important. I mean that they have their practices, and maybe those ones are not mine, but this is not crucial. In this moment, I think that the fact they are they have met is crucial. This is because one of the points of the power is that and the system. So the system of the power is that that our climate crisis cannot be. Cannot have a solution, and they cannot fire people, workers, because they mystificate. They say that we want people not to have. The pay, but this is not the point. Of course, we are trying to talk about a new system, and so proposing new ways of working, to work it doesn't mean to serve the system and being slaves and so on. Being victims of the system, but it means it can mean a good thing. To work together is not a bad thing, and we are not saying this. We just say that this is the work that we don't want and to do. So the meeting, the link between the two parts. So environmentalist, I mean, easily the environmentalist movement and the workers' movement is something that can make rise up the contradiction of the system. So when the system says we cannot fire people, you want people become poorer and poorer, etc. This is fake, deeply fake. And this meeting, this working together between those two parts, is a new thing, and can be the road. To tell people that environmentalism is not something that deals with the people that doesn't have anything else to do, but is our life. It's about life. This fucking problem is about life.
A report there from Raymond Grenfeld on the streets of Bologna. He was reporting on the Insurgiamo movement, a new coalition of environmentalists, workers and other anti-capitalists that is emerging in Italy.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
We have some time for some headlines that you may have missed in the mainstream media. Zoe.
In Chad, security forces shot and killed dozens of anti-government protesters last Thursday in the country's two largest cities. Some 50 people were killed, hundreds injured. Protesters were demanding an end to transitional military rule and a return to democracy. Chad has been mired in a protracted political crisis following the death of former President Idriss Deby, who was killed on the battlefield in April of last year. This all comes as Chad declared a state of emergency over catastrophic flooding that demolished crops and livestock, worsening food insecurity in the region.
Staying in Africa and in Sudan, more than 150 people have been killed and scores more injured during 2 days of fighting in the southern state of Blue Nile. It's the latest in a series of clashes between the Hausa people and rival groups in southern Sudan that have left hundreds of people dead this year while driving tens of thousands from their homes.
Last Wednesday, 9 climate activists with the group Scientists Rebellion staged a non-violent civil disobedience protest at the showroom of Volkswagen factory in the city of Wolfsburg, Germany. The protesters glued scientific research papers to different models of Porsches that were on display. They then superglued to attach themselves to the floor. Protester Gianluca Grimalda said that the auto industry is responsible for some 12% of Germany's greenhouse gas emissions.
That's pretty badass. I love scientists.
Very cool.
In US labour news, a tentative agreement has been reached between thousands of unionised mental health care workers and Kaiser Permanente, the US's largest non-profit healthcare organisation, ending a 2-month strike. The National Union of Healthcare Workers has been denouncing chronic staff shortages at Kaiser, forcing patients to wait months for an appointment. The strike began in August, led by thousands of workers in California. Kaiser healthcare workers in Hawaii, Oregon and Washington State later joined.
Australia has promised millions of dollars in support for Pacific Island nations to address the existential threat of climate change, as well as funds for Australia's police deployment in the Solomon Islands, regional aerial surveillance and an Australian Border Force network. Foreign Minister Penny Wong, speaking to the Pacific Way conference in French Polynesia, said Australia would increase its total budget for overseas development assistance by $1.4 billion Australian dollars over the next 4 years. Some $900 million Australian dollars will go directly to the Pacific region.
And that brings us to an end for this week's Indie Media. We will be back at 11 a.m. Next Monday with Zoe in the hot seat. If you want to listen back to the show, you can go to rtrfm.com.au/shows/indiemedia, one word. You can also check out the tracks that we've played, and we also put our interviews up on our SoundCloud. I think we're catching up on that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Everything will go up on our SoundCloud, including Ray's interview from today and mine from earlier as well.
Yeah, excellent.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.